This HedgeGhoul series of podcasts is brought to you by History Ireland Magazine and the Wardwell Group. For more information or to subscribe, visit historyireland.com.
Well, good evening, history lovers, and welcome to the latest History Ireland HedgeGhoul with editor Tommy Graham in the chair. Now, Ballyshannon may or may not be the oldest town in Ireland, but it has certainly been the site of human settlement and activity for thousands of years and has been mapped since the late 16th century. Now, it is a subject of the Royal Irish Academy's latest, that's number 32, Irish Historic Towns Atlas series. And I'm joined by its compiler, Angela Byrne, on my left, and Pádraig Travers, former president of St. Patrick's College, Drumcondra, a professional historian and a native of the town, as am I. Angela isn't, but you tell me your grandfather worked on the Erin scheme.
That's right.
More on that later. So more or less local. Okay, Andrew, just before we start and before we focus on Ballyshannon, just talk to us a bit about the Irish Historic Towns Atlas series, because this is a European-wide project.
Yeah, it is. Thanks a million, Tommy, and thanks everybody for coming. I see a lot of familiar faces, a lot of friends. Thanks a million. Can I borrow your copy of the Atlas, please, Pádraig? Sure. So the Irish Historic Towns Atlas was founded in the 1980s and it's housed in the Royal Irish Academy. We're very lucky to have that. For our National Historic Towns Atlas series, not all the European projects have that level of institutional and state support. So this is the Atlas for anyone who hasn't seen it, and apologies to those on the audio that won't see what I'm holding up, but hopefully they will.
It's got dancing on the radio. Yeah.
Hopefully they will get their hands on copies before too long if they haven't already. Every Atlas is composed of three main parts. The first part you see when you open it is the text section, which has two kind of parts to it. The first is the essay of about 10 or 11,000 words that I compiled after I had finished most of the research. And then the second main part is what we call the topographical information, where information about sites in the town, specific buildings and specific locations, is organised under 22 thematic headings. They're presented chronologically, except for the streets, which are done alphabetically. And every feature is given a grid reference. And then you can, with your text in your hand, you could click on the digital version of the Atlas, which was launched last week in the Royal Irish Academy. If you go on to www.ihta.ie, you'll be able to find the link there to the digital Atlas of Ballyshannon. So all the known sites that were included in this paper copy are represented in the digital Atlas. You can click on each dot and see what exactly was happening in that spot. So maybe you'll find a spot sitting over where your house is today or where you go to school or something like that. And you can click on it and see what was happening there over time. The next and the really alluring part of every atlas are the maps, the loose facsimile maps. Every atlas, because it's part of a European scheme, it has to have certain mapping requirements to be part of the scheme. And this is part of the explanation as to why Ballyshannon is the only town in County Donegal that will be included. There are particular historic maps that were only done for Ballyshannon and not for any other town in our county, which is why Ballyshannon has this particular honour of representing County Donegal in the Historic Towns Atlas series. The first four maps are the core maps. They're included in every issue for all of the 30-odd towns that have been done across the island, north and south, and they're drawn from the Ordnance Survey. And then as you go through, you find facsimile reproductions of historic maps. In the case of Ballyshannon, going from the late 16th century right up to a very recent LIDAR hillshade visualization, which I will talk about in a few minutes, and a recent aerial photograph. So I don't know if I need to go into much more detail, Tommy, but as Tommy mentioned, the Historic Towns Atlas for Ballyshannon is part of a wider European scheme. It joins now 620 other towns across Europe that are part of the same scheme. So people can sit down in theory and compare directly settlement patterns and urban growth patterns in Ballyshannon with towns in Croatia or Slovenia or all over Europe.
So it's a bit like the old Latin mass, you know, anywhere in Europe and the format will be the same. You know? Now, Pádraig, you've reviewed the Atlas in the latest issue of History Ireland, which will be on sale, by the way, in the foyer, Mary Sheeran assures me. So is there any good, Pádraig?
It's fantastic. Irish history hasn't been very well served by these large-scale projects, but a significant exception is the Historic Towns Atlas series. And it's fantastic to see Billy Shannon joining the towns that have already been done. This is the 32nd. And it's a significant achievement for the historical geographers who've been involved in the series. One of the things it does is it allows us to compare urbanisation in different parts of the country. The addition of Ballyshannon, I think, is important because there have been very few done on the West Coast, and certainly in the Northwest Coast. And Ballyshannon is a small town. So it provides a different kind of a case study for examination. As a native of Ballyshannon, I'm delighted to see the town included because the Atlas contains it's a gold mine of material. It's the gift that will continue to give because it's full of material which will be useful for students who are studying. It'll be useful for natives of the town who are interested in the development of the town or the heritage of the town. And it'll be interesting for people who are looking at their forebears, at their genealogy and trying to trace where they came from and the sort of place Ballyshannon was. And an added bonus is that it's not just the hard copy, that it's available digitally and that you're able to not just look at Ballyshannon, but look at other towns in the series in Ireland and in Europe.
Now, just before I go back to Angela, just to explain the format of this, for anyone who hasn't been at a History Ireland Head School before, you're at school, you know, you sit up straight in your seat, pay attention. Now, the thing is, this Atlas is so good, it's been launched twice. And you also had a third session here in the town, didn't you, Angela, recently?
I've done a few things. I worked with the Ballyshannon Regeneration Group on a big day of celebrating Ballyshannon for Heritage Week in 2024.
Now, what I'm getting at here is how many people in the audience have already seen, not necessarily read the whole thing, but have looked at this? Just if you put your hand up. Now, the reason I'm saying that is because you've no excuse whatsoever not to ask questions that way. And Angela doesn't mind questions like, where's my house in this map? Even those kind of dumb questions that are acceptable. And just bear in mind that all this has been recorded and will go up as a podcast on our website. So keep it clean. Okay, Angela. Okay, so the thing is, this is a visual project. So let's start showing some of the stuff here.
So
we know what's in this collection.
I've picked out a half or dozen or so of the maps. Some of them are my favourites and some of them I think just kind of sum up what the Atlas project is about really well. And I hope you can make it out well. The light in the room is quite bright. But fret not, everything I'm showing on the screen is in the hard copy Atlas. So you could always just go and pick one up afterwards if you did want to have another look. The first one I wanted to show you is this pink and green coloured map. It's one of the things that makes the Irish Historic Towns Atlas series distinctive and really special. We call it in the Atlas circles Map 2. And what it is a planimetrically adjusted for accuracy version of the first Ordnance Survey town plan of Ballyshannon. To be in the Atlas series, your town has to have been mapped by the Ordnance Survey in that first edition of town plans in the 1830s and 40s. So the one for Ballyshannon, because the Ordnance Survey started up in the Foyle and worked their way south, Ballyshannon was early in those town plans. Its date is 1835. So we get a snapshot of the town, you know, just before the famine. And this is, as I said, planimetrically accurate. It's shaded, for instance, I'm sure there up the back, the red buildings are popping out at you. They're the public buildings. And the key to this map is on a loose sheet at the back of the Atlas. I used to draw these maps for the Atlas back about a millennium ago, early this century.
And I used, quill, was it?
Yeah, I did used to draw them by hand with ink and giant sheets of tracing paper. It's all done much more technologically now in the Atlas office. But just to note that this is one of the things that makes the Towns Atlas series special. And it's one of the things that facilitates the comparative aspect with other towns across Europe. Every town that's included in the European scheme was mapped around this time to around this scale. And that's what facilitates the comparative element.
Angie, can I just point out something on the map, right? I because I took a stroll around the town earlier, and it's like a different town. I mean, it really brings up. I always wonder, for example, where the cavalry barracks was, somewhere in the rock. There it is there, right? And De La Salle School was here, John Murphy. Now, there's two little fragments of that left. The entrance here, you know, you go down the back of Sweeney's, see John Sweeney there. That was your private entrance that the brothers started using it, so it became a public entrance, I believe. Anyway, there's a little bit of stonework there with a few of those little slits, you know, the gun slits. And then there's another one, it's like where foxes used to live, where Ken Fox, his house was somewhere here. So there's two little fragments of that left. But without this map, you wouldn't know what they were, you know. But that's just typical of other things in the town. So keep your eyes peeled, guys, as you walk around, you know. This really reveals the whole town a whole new way, you know.
Yeah, and that distinctive kind of quadrilinear layout of the public housing up in that part of what was the public housing that was built in the mid-20th century, that is retaining that stamp of the earlier barracks, which I find so interesting.
But from a contemporary perspective, it's interesting to note the things that are no longer there, that where you look at it and you say, oh, so there's a distillery, a brewery, a tan yard, an ice house. The fish lane was on the mall, the customs house, the market house, all of the things that were part of and parcel of Ballyshannon in the 1830s that are now long gone. It's lovely to see them brought back to life and look at Ballyshannon as it was then and compare the number of things that have gone.
Yeah, and even just looking at the street names, the next time you walk down the mall, for instance, you're walking down Fish Lane. Yeah. So you can sit and pore over this map and transplant yourself back 190 years to walk around Ballyshannon in your imagination with this sheet of paper.
Waterloo Place, I don't know when the Battle of Waterloo took place, but that's no longer there. The Bachelor's Walk, there seems to be a row of houses behind where the Bachelor's Walk is now.
Yeah, so there was a lot of changes up in that area with the coming of the railway. And of course, this map captures a lot of the kind of, say, poorer housing, that ribbons of kind of less good dwellings that people were living in, thatched houses and so on, that were then later on cleared and those people were relocated to public housing. The Waterloo Place thing is interesting. There's Waterloo Places all over towns in Ulster, especially, and possibly around the rest of the country too, but that was about 20 years before this map was made.
There was a row called Slate Row, which is slightly, but apparently they were all attached, and one of them was burnt down, I think, because of a fire in the nearby Donegal Railway. And because it was attached, it easily caught fire. It was called the Burnt Houses. Now, Dennis McGee's daughter lives in it now.
Yeah, well, one of the names I noticed on one of the old maps was where Port of the Sun is, was Port Nassau. And I'm assuming that's Orange Nassau.
Yeah. I think all sorts of elisions were made in terms of place names, especially. And place names are horribly complicated and often best left to the lexicographers and the linguistic experts. But I think you're right with the inference you're drawing there, Tommy. So my next pick of the map, the Baxter / Boasio map made in around 1600, that's also included in the Atlas in facsimile. And why I picked out this map, it's two reasons. One, what the map shows, and then two, who made it. So first, what the map shows us is, it's first of all, you'll notice it's oriented east-west, which was normal for maps in the early modern period. I sometimes get people saying, well, these maps are the wrong way around. At the time they were made, they were very much the right way around, and we've only later started looking at things north-south. So we can see Ballyshannon here, positioned on the river. You can see the little cluster and hopefully make out the suggested tower house. What I love about this map is the routeway that it shows, going all the way from Deep Connaught right up into the northwest. Follow this route through to Barnesmore Gap, and where it's leading us onward from there is to Grainonavalloch and into the deep northwest. And one of my favourite quotes that kind of captures how the English thought about this terrain at the time is an English captain, Thomas Lee, in about 1594. He's writing about Ballyshannon, and he says, it's the only passage which the rebellious Irish have to go to and fro to assist any traitor that may rebel there. Mm-hmm. So, of course, this map has been made around the time of the 9 Years' War. Ballyshannon is really strategically located at that time. The town, or the settlement in the area, gets devastated at different points and comes under attack during that conflict. So, for example, it's besieged by the English in 1597, occupied in 1602, and then abandoned by the O'Donnells in 1607 before being seized and re-granted to Folliot and Trinity College.
But Angela, would it be true to say that this area then was a war zone throughout time? Because it was a southern, the river was a southern border of Tyrconnell. And, you know, the point is, I can see that moving back and forth, right? Like Belgium, you know, the cockpit of Europe, you know?
Yeah, that's a flashpoint. Like Ballyshannon's location geographically is really interesting. And I think something that's worth kind of transporting ourselves back mentally through time to think about it as this border zone. We're used to thinking of a different border in our own lifetimes. But this conflict zone between the Gaelic clans, even before the English come and wage war there, and it's something I've gone to a fair bit of detail about in the Atlas. Park may want to come in on this too.
This map, I think, is particularly interesting because it illustrates something about maps in general. Maps are rarely value-free. Maps are
like history.
Yeah, maps have a context. They're freighted with meaning, and when you try and unpick them, you see either a social or an economic or a political or an imperial context. Baxter, who was responsible for this map, was essentially a spy. He came to Sligo. He moved north. And he drew this map for military purposes for the British Crown. This is at the height of the Tudor conquest, and as you mentioned, Angela, the Nine Years' War is still going. This is 1600. It's before the Battle of Conseil. So Donegal, Ballyshannon, is still part of the area of the influence of the O'Donnells. So it's one side in a major conflict. So the map is drawn for a military purpose. And it's true of a lot of the maps in the series that they reflect. The maps begin being drawn, it's not an accident, at the time of the Tudor conquest in the late 16th century. That leads to the establishment of Ballyshannon as a plantation town. And then so many more of the maps leading down to the Ordnance Survey in the 1830s all have a sort of a deeper meaning when you begin to unpick it. I mean, we're talking, is it the 10th anniversary of the death of Brian Friel being celebrated at this festival, Brian Friel's Translations, which is set in the 1830s at the time of the Ordnance Survey, is exploring some of the cultural impact of the kinds of changes that are taking place. But it's interesting that after he wrote Translations in 1980, Friel followed that up in 1989 with Making History, which was set exactly in this period. It tells the story of Hugh O'Neill at the time of the Nine Years' War, at a time of significant transformation. So obviously Brian Friel was very conscious of the kind of changes that take place as a result of the collapse of Gaelic Ireland in the late 16th century and what follows.
Yeah, absolutely. And just to add to that about Baxter himself, she rightly said he was a spy and he was working to divide and conquer the O'Donnell and the Connacht clans. And for his work during that period, he was rewarded with land grants in Connacht. And all of that story is wrapped up in that one sheet of paper, that one map.
And just, of course, the term ordnance means artillery. So the whole reason for drawing the map is to find out where can you fire your artillery from A to B and so on, not have a hill stuck in the middle of it or whatever. Porrick, actually, I wonder, there's a question I forgot to ask you before I went to Angela earlier, which is this presumably apocryphal claim that Ballyshannon is the oldest town in Ireland. Like, so what's the story?
Well, like a lot of people here,
feel like we're the oldest town now. That's a different question.
When I went to primary school 60 years ago over the rock, I was taught in third class that Ballyshannon was established by Partillon and the Partillonians, and they were the earliest inhabitants of Ireland. And as I grew up, I believe that was true, and maybe it was true. But in exploring where that story comes from, it comes from the 11th century monks who sat down to write a history of Ireland or the story of Ireland, the so-called Lower Gwala, the Book of Invasions, which tells the story of Ireland or purports to tell the story of Ireland from the Garden of Eden through the flood down to contemporary times in the 11th century. And that tells the story of Partholón and his arrival at the urn, which he called Samer. And then it tells the story of Inis Samer, which was named after his wife's dog. One thing we didn't learn in school was that Partholón's wife had an affair with one of his hirelings, and in a fit of anger, Partholón killed the dog, and the dog was buried on Inis Samer, or sometimes called Dog's Isle, ever since. Well, is that story true? Ore McAllister, the archaeologist who did a translation of the Lower Gwalla, said that most of the historic events that are, or purported historic events that are described in the Lower Gwalla, you have to attach a certain pinch of salt to most of them. It's interesting, though, that the Four Masters, who wrote the Annals of the Four Masters in the 1630s, that they did a version of the transcription of the Book of Invasions, the Lower Gwalla, in the early 1630s. And they repeat that story about Partholón. And that's the story that came down as a piece of legend or mythology. All we can safely say is there has been settlement in this area from the earliest times. But whether that you can trace that back to Partholón or not is another question.
Now, Angela, just on the Baxter map there, and you're talking about Ballyshan's strategic position, just in the long durée, though, the whole military aspect here, it seems to me, is key. I mean, there's military installations, barracks, you know, north, south the river, and they change purpose over the years. So just talk to us about that. I mean, how much of the economy of the town was military, essentially?
Yeah, I'll go back for the benefit of those that are in the room to map two, the reconstruction map, just to consider this question. So I have a hobby horse about Ballyshannon being a port town, and a lot of you that have heard me speaking about the town will know that. But the garrison town is also crucially important. So William Allingham, in his memoirs of what it was like growing up here in the 1820s and 30s, writes a lot about what it was like to grow up in a garrison town. And he describes the military men walking through the town, especially to go to church and so on. And of course, when he's describing that, they would have been leaving the Rock Barracks on the south side and walking across the bridge to go up, most of them, to St. Anne's Church on the other side of the river. So you can just picture what they were like proceeding through the town of a Sunday. But we have three major military sites here at different points. The one that's easily forgotten is Mullinashy Fort. And I actually wanted to say something about that later, but I might go to it now if this is a natural point. And that's to draw your attention to the LIDAR map in the Atlas. This is the hillshade visualization that I mentioned earlier on. The Ballyshannon Atlas is the first in the Towns Atlas series to include this.
From the frontiers of technology. Here.
Yeah, this is a really special thing, and it's beautiful and also very, very informative. Basically, it's a map that's created using an airborne scanning laser. It is extremely technological. Please don't ask me to explain the technology. I'm a fan of the output, even if I don't understand very well how it's made. Basically, it's almost a 3D representation because it's showing small variations in elevation, literally at a couple of centimetres, and it removes the vegetation. So the first thing, when I was shown this in the Atlas office during the summer, when the Atlas was very nearly finished production, this thing was put in front of me. I didn't have access to it before that. The thing that leapt out to me was this, and I hope you can see this little quadrangle behind St. Anne's Church. That's the Star Fort. That's the early modern Star Fort. That's the birth of Ballyshannon as a garrison town, really. So the O'Donnells had their tower house, which is the first defence. And then when the English come in, they provide themselves with this other defence on a prominent site in the town. They're overlooking the harbour, the river. They can see everything approaching. It's a stunning, there's a stunning view from up there. Yeah, Park.
Can I just, on the LIDAR, it's a form of radar. Mm. And its first use was when the lunar landings. If it looks like a lunar landscape, that's no accident. When the surface of the moon was mapped, it was with that technology. So that was the first major use of it. And it's currently used in your iPhones, and it's also used in the automatic self-drive cars, or the cars you see in San Francisco that you don't have a driver. It uses that LiDAR technology. So it really is cutting edge, and it's fantastic to see this one in the Atlas.
It's an absolutely superb addition, I think, to the Towns Atlas series, and hopefully other towns subsequently in the series will benefit from this as well. And I'm sure everybody who lives in the town presently will be really interested to check their back garden and so on in it. And the thing that is really valuable is that it's showing us stuff that a surveyor of a traditional map might not discern on the ground. So I think it's really, really valuable. I did have some people ask me about these strange markings in the water. This is because the technology struggles to scan areas of water, bodies of water. So those funny quadrangular and triangular shapes that are appearing there don't mean anything. Don't be alarmed. It's just how
the body of water when you look at it.
Yeah. It's just how the technology responds to bodies of water. So will I go on to the next map, Tommy?
Yeah.
So the next one I wanted to pick out is this beauty. It's part of the Down survey that, again, a lot of the history fans will know, and it's around 1655 this map is made. So this is, you know, Ballyshannon now that the plantation's well and underway, but it's also a map that's been made at the end of a period of tremendous conflict on the island. We had tremendous bloodshed, farms and agricultural land being razed to the ground, a terrible trauma visited on people of the island. And we also have this map being made at a time where it was the map historian J.G. Sims who said that at this time, Ulster was still the part of Ireland. Prior to this time, Ulster was the part of Ireland that was least known to the English and the most imperfectly mapped. But now we come into the Down survey. And of course, because of the plantation, that's been turned on its head. Ulster is being more perfectly mapped, being better known. And we see Ballyshannon town here represented. Again, as in a lot of these early maps, you know, not to be taken terribly literally when you look at just the little cluster and indication there of urban identity. And we can look at the texts that go along with these maps to fill it out a wee bit more for us. So what it tells us is that there's many thatched houses in Ballyshannon. And the survey of population that followed 4 years later tells us that Ballyshannon had a population of 134 taxpayers. Now, that's, you know, you can multiply that by whatever power and to get the actual number of inhabitants. And in Ballyshannon, English and Scottish settlers made up just under half of that number. So the town, as you can see, has been quite divided in terms of religion, culture, language and so on. But the thing that really struck me looking at that source was that Ballyshannon was the most populated town in County Donegal at the time. And it remained one of the top three towns in the county until Letterkenny really takes off after independence. So Raphoe was the next most populated at 104 taxpayers, and only Letterkenny and Donegal town had a number above 70. The rest of the county was extremely rural still.
Angela, when did Ballyshannon get two members of parliament? Because it was separate to the county. The town had two members of parliament.
Yeah.
That would be James I probably?
Well, it certainly wasn't before James I. I think sometime probably from the 1650s, but I'm not sure the exact date.
No, but that's the point. It was the only town in Ballyshannon that was a borough.
Town was like this map. Hence, this map to me is important, not just because of it's following on in this intense period of conflict in the mid-17th century, but it's also showing us that Ballyshannon, when you put it together with the documentary evidence that goes alongside it, the sense of population, the town is growing rapidly in importance in terms of the Northwest, in terms of County Donegal.
I have a question. You mentioned the number of taxpayers in the town, but I also noticed in the text that it mentioned that there were seven Irish taxpayers in the satellite village of Asseroe. And I wondered whether that was a remnant of a monastic village around Asseroe, there was a monastic village around the monastery long before Ballyshannon was created as a plantation town.
I did something a little bit unorthodox in the Atlas in that I did talk about the settlement out around Asaro Abbey a wee bit, especially in the early period, because I didn't think about it as a monastic town because it's not necessarily my area of expertise, and the whole question of what's a monastic town is quite controversial and fraught. But I think there's a lot of research to be done on Asaro in terms of its status as a satellite to Ballyshannon, be that as a monastic town or as a fishing settlement. And it could have taken off instead of Ballyshannon if the harbour had been right for that. So you often see in the early sources, the reference to the harbour is not calling it Ballyshannon Harbour, it calls it Asaro Harbour often. So Asaro, I think, needs a lot more research. Maybe somebody in this room would like a project.
Andrew, a colleague of yours in the RA has written a book about Ireland and the Camino, and she lists Asaro as a departure point in the 13th century for the Camino, which I think were mostly, I don't know, maybe the Maguires from Anna, who were nuts about going to Santiago in the 13th century. And just, I just can't, you just said, like, was there a harbour at Asaro? It's listed as a departure point.
Yeah, it's hard to be precise. They're talking about somewhere in the Erin estuary. And they're often referring, and I think because of the status of the monastery, the place comes to be identified by that name rather than the name Ballyshannon. But they're talking in broad sense about the harbour that's located down at the bottom of the hill here.
Well, let's talk about the harbour, right? Because by the mid-18th century, Ballyshannon was a medium-sized harbour. I mean, what would it have compared with, right? Because we're going to talk about its decline, right? But I want to just get some sort of comparative sense here. I mean, I'm assuming that the coast was dotted with small harbours like Ballyshannon all over.
It absolutely was. Like, I've talked about Ballyshannon as being one of County Donegal's windows on the world. But Moville was also on the go from an early time, but takes off completely with steam travel and as a point of departure along the Derry route out of the Foyle. I've got some figures about emigration from various ports in Ireland from the 1830s. And Ballyshannon is lower down the list in terms of quantity. There's no question about that. But to me, what's really interesting about Ballyshannon is not necessarily the size or the value of the trade or the amount of emigrants that are leaving from the port, but just the breadth of the geographical connections that the place has. So there's direct trade going all the way from Norway across to New Brunswick, down to the Caribbean, and going into Spain, France, the Netherlands. For such a tiny place to have had such rich connections, to me, is the story rather than the amount.
Yeah, but does this illustrate a wider point? There's a book just published, and I just can't remember the title of the part. You might be able to help me out on this. But it's making the point that what characterised Ireland in the, and we're talking about that over the last 200 years, 300 years, is its modernity, not its backwardness. It's the degree to which it was integrated into the whole economies, you know, of the Atlantic, of the British Isles and so on, right? So that would seem to bear that in mind as well. The idea of Ballyshannon as a kind of a small, isolated town, it isn't a small, isolated, you know, it's a small, connected town.
I'm not sure the book you're referring to.
It'll come back to me in a minute. But I was struck by the sophistication of the economy of the town. So if we're to kind of draw an arc, then its beginnings is in the plantation period, right? Say 1650s. So when does it reach its peak? What's peak Ballyshannon?
In terms of it being referred to as a town, right? If we're talking in the kind of definition of the word, a place with streets, clusters of dwellings, a variety of trades, and so on, if we can go back to the early 17th century when the place is first documented and described as a town. So there's documentary evidence for that from the early 17th century. And it's the plantation that really allows the place to take off. But it's also the strategic location. So it's an entrepot for the bigger town of Enniskillen, the whole Leitrim, Fermanagh, North Sligo area. It's the entry point into the rest of Donegal and the far northwest. And it has that crucial, the highway of every century until the 20th. The highway is the ocean. If you are a sea town, a sea port, you're going to have these connections and you're going to have merchants come to the town.
Water connects people, doesn't it?
Water connects people. Yeah. And that's what happened to Ballyshannon. Merchants came to Ballyshannon trying to make a living. One lovely example is Anne Jane Thornton, who some of you might know about. In the 1830s, when she was a teenager, she ran off to sea, assumed the identity of a cabin boy trying to follow her love to Canada. She had been born in England. she was brought to Ballyshannon by her father, who was an English merchant, because he came here thinking he could, you know, develop his business and make a living. To me, that's kind of surprising. He would leave central England, where there was a strong economy, and come to somewhere like Ballyshannon. But the merchants thrived here, and that legacy is in the main streets of this town. The 18th and 19th century townhouses that were built by those mercantile families, that's the legacy of that thriving period. But to answer your question, finally, the port goes into decline from the kind of second half of the 19th century. That's due to several factors. One is the sandbar, so the big steamships can't come in. Then the coming of the railway means it's easier for traders and emigrants and everybody to go to Derry or Sligo.
Well, there's an interesting point. The railways, right?
Yeah.
Which would normally count as a plus in one's economy, but in fact it was a minus for Ballyshannon, because it just meant stuff, people as well, of course. And that was its effect in other parts of Ireland. It just facilitated mass emigration.
Yeah.
So presumably then just meant the goods could be sent up to Derry or to Sligo, yeah, or somewhere else.
Yeah, and people.
Yeah. But
the place goes into severe decline, so that by the 1870s, the town's first serious local historian, Hugh Allingham, is writing a list of all the trades that no longer survive in the town and showing that as a signal of endemic decline. So by the 1930s, the shipping is gone.
No, because the normal narrative is the partition was the big problem in Ballyshannon, right? So but this atlas...
The decline predates that.
Yes, I'm sorry, guys. Decline is the norm in this town. Right? We're going to reverse all that here today, of course.
Ballyshannon had hundreds of years where it was the principal town in County Donegal, one of the principal towns in the Northwest. That's one of the legacies of this town. The other thing I wanted to say about the economy of the place, aside from port, was the garrison. Mm. This brings loads of wealth to the town. And Park, I might let you in here because I've been talking for a while.
No. I think partition, the decline of Ballyshannon is a 19th century decline, but partition certainly didn't help.
It didn't help.
It certainly cut off that hinterland, that route towards Enniskillen, up the valley of the Earn, along all of that was cut off, and it's a very significant loss for Ballyshannon. But can I just go back before you leave the Down Survey map, which essentially Down Survey map is again a map that is mapping land to be seized
and taxed.
And I was struck by the fact that earlier in the plantation that Trinity College had got 4,000 acres in Tyrhiu. And if I can make a slightly mischievous point, Trinity College renamed the Berkeley Library because of Berkeley's connection with slaves. And a lot of university institutions in the United Kingdom are apologising for their connection with exploitation and so on and so forth. I wonder whether the Ballyshannon Regeneration Group should approach Trinity College for an apology for the seizure of... for the seizure of land in Ballyshannon, but also for a contribution for the regeneration of Ballyshannon, given what they took out of Ballyshannon. Yeah. Sorry about that, Tommy. I know you're a graduate of Trinity College. So.
No, thank you. And just before we do move on from that particular map, there you began talking about the Abbey, and it's very interesting just to hear that or put that idea out there that the town could have been called Asserow rather than Ballyshannon. But the Abbey Asserow, just in terms of the research and the importance of it, we've been working through the Regeneration Group and through my good friend Joe Gallagher, Heritage Officer from the Galway County Council here, to try and do something to make safe the Abbey for a number of years. And just we're successful in getting a bit of funding, and work started on it just yesterday. So there'll be scaffolding going up between today and tomorrow to remove the vegetation and to stabilise the walls and all that kind of stuff. But that's all really good. But what comes next, I think, is the really interesting part of it, the interpretation, maybe using some of the modern technologies to see what Abbey Asserow looked like, where the footprint was, what lies beneath. It's really intriguing. And when we were down a couple of days ago with conservation officer, our conservation architect, and that as some of the final preparations, we did notice some of the old drain that runs underneath, which according to Geraldine Carville, who wrote a book on Asserow in the 1980s,
She said that she heard the water running underneath her feet, and it was the only Cistercian abbey that she has done that in all the ones that she has studied. It's the only abbey where she has heard the water running beneath her feet, and the drains are running under there, and it's thought to be a fairly sophisticated domestic system of, you know, washing, cooking, and then toilet facility, you know, as the drain runs along, the various facilities are incorporated into that. So that's one of the very small parts of interest of Asaro, and there's loads more to discover.
And thank you, Paulie, for reminding me of the guilt I share for Trinity owning all the land around here, and being an ex-ESB man as well. I'm on in the firing line here. We'll come to that in a second. Do you want to move on to the next map?
Yeah, and actually, Bart's mention of taxation is brilliant. It leads us really nicely into this. So the next...
pay attention, this is valuations,
guys. Yeah, valuation.
Know where your house is located.
Yeah, this is, you know, history lovers stuff right here, the valuation, Griffith's valuation of 1856, set up for taxation purposes as well. Richard Griffith himself was an engineer and a geologist. He worked on rails and roads around Ireland, but he's best remembered for overseeing the valuation that was established in 1846. So I have here a section of the town that's included in the atlas, but I wanted to show this, which is the text map included in the essay in the Ballyshannon Atlas, where I went through the lists and mapped on as best I could with the help of Sarah Geerty in the Atlas office, who's the cartographic editor for the project, and the value of each building in the historic core of the town. And I had a few observations to make on that. And I thought especially, you know, the Pert area kind of gets a bit neglected because a lot of the kind of the best buildings are on the north side of the town.
Quick question, right? I presume Pert means port, you know, Eastport. But the point is, it's a long way from the port. So how did we get the name?
Yeah, I'm actually not sure how it got the name, and maybe somebody locally might know a bit more about that. But I was glad to include the name Pert, P-U-R-T, in the kind of local dialect, and to be able to do that, I feel, is important.
This map explains an awful lot to me. This explains all the prejudices I experience as a Southsider in Ballyshannon.
Absolutely.
This is like Crumlin in Monopoly, right? All the way along here, right? Along the Pert. Of course, this is before the palatial ESB house were built, before it was up the road. And then you have these mountains then, in the town, so not too many. I mean,
The darker colours, for anyone who can't read the key up in the corner, the darker colours and the darker shapes are the higher value, and the open symbols are the lower values. And to just bamboozle with some figures for y'all, right? Across the whole town, there was only three private buildings that had a valuation of £40 or higher, right? And that was the distillery at Westport, one private house on the main street, and the brewery down on the Mall. The overwhelming majority of properties in the town were valued at under £5. So out of a total I counted of 696 lots, there was 489 valued at under £5. There was entire streets, as Tommy's just been pointing out, that were composed almost completely of buildings and dwellings in that lower classification. And that is even more pronounced on the south side of the river. So to look at Eastport, right? There's 84 buildings valued on Eastport. 72 of them are in the lowest valuation. In West Rock, 37 out of 46 total are in the lowest valuation. And East Rock has 32 buildings. Every single one of them is in the lowest bracket, right? There was a nice contemporary quote that kind of captures all this. It was the Parliamentary Gazetteer. Now, if anybody else is familiar with this source, the writer for the Parliamentary Gazetteer is really grumpy. There's a grumpy tone across the whole book. But in describing the south side of Ballyshannon, he probably writes, "The Pert is an aggregately wretched suburb and consists principally of an irregular street of per buildings." So he summed up all the figures I gave you just in a sentence there.
And then they built a new road along the back of it, like, which exposed the beauty of all those houses, which are still there to this day.
Yeah.
And like as late as 1898, there's still problems on the south side of the town. So I found just one quote from the town commissioner's books they received complaints of offensive matter oozing from underneath the houses, flowing onto and over the public street at Restrock. Now, look, that's not a problem that's unique to Ballyshannon. I've looked at these books for Buncrana, Letterkenny, Ballyshannon, Dunloe, different parts of the county. There was desperate problems with urban housing.
Sorry, Andrew, that reminds me of the toilet in the old Carrick Pie. John, do you remember the old school, the original school? You wouldn't know what you'd find in the Jacks. Anyway, go on.
Yeah, no, and Parrott might want to come in here at this point.
It just reminds Tommy's sense of grievance coming from the south side of Ballyshannon and grown up as a disadvantage in this inclusive age. We include people from the other side of the river. But it does remind me of something that struck me about the Atlas, that you don't get that much sense of the ecclesiastical divide between not just two parishes, but two dioceses, and the kind of social impact that has on how people experience living in Ballyshannon. The fact that you're dealing not just with two parish priests and two bishops, two different sets of schools, and you know, it is particularly as the town developed, it's quite illogical. You know, you wonder why the boundaries weren't redrawn at some stage.
But the boundaries were there before the town, though. That's the reason.
Yeah.
I mean, they didn't put a line through the middle of a town. There was no town.
Yeah.
So all those boundaries are 12th century.
And like so many boundaries, it follows.
I asked you this question last week. Yeah. The answer is in your text, by the way, slightly hidden. In your start of your second paragraph gives the answer, which is that the river was the southern boundary of Tyrconnell, you know, most of the time.
Oh, yeah, the O'Donnells would dispute that. They would have claimed rights toward eastwards towards Fermanagh into Maguire country and westwards certainly down as far as Sligo. And that part of their expansion is the attempt to assert that control over the sub-chieftains in those areas.
No, but I know that there was a Landscapes of South Ulster was the name of a big coffee table book that came out in the early 90s, the last of the pre-digital. You'd love this, Angela. Bishop Joseph Duffy actually was heavily involved in it, you know. Never left your job, interfere with your work, you know. That's what he was really interested in. But they were trying to delineate all the parishes of Clogher, right? But some of them they weren't able to. It's like these maps of Africa, you know, boundary, you know, unresolved, you know. To be aroused, you know, they didn't know where the boundaries were. But the boundaries here are very odd because the Daltons were friends of ours, lived out the Balique Road, built a bungalow out there. But they're in Rafoe, but they're south of the river. So it doesn't even follow the river. It's anyway, that's a whole head school, separate. We'll come back to that one. And it's a bit outside the purview of the Atlas, to be honest. But it did affect our day-to-day lives, that's for sure, right?
But these boundaries do matter, though, because, for example, a contemporary one is the boundary of the political constituencies. The fact that Ballyshannon is not part of the rest of Donegal, the fact that it's part of Sligo and Leitrim, and that has a significant impact on development. There's a sense in which the rise of County Donegal from the Local Government Act of 1898, that in some ways it disadvantaged Ballyshannon because Ballyshannon prior to then was part of the poor law union in incorporated parts of out towards Balique and parts of Sligo, parts of Leitrim. But the locus of power changes after 1898. And it moves further down the county. And Ballyshannon, from being at the heart of Donegal, arguably in the 18th or 17th, 18th, 19th century, in the 20th century becomes very much peripheral.
Yeah, but not intellectually.
Oh, right. God, no.
Andrew, we'll go for the painting.
We'll go for the last thing. Now, I said I was going to show maps, but you'll all forgive me. You'll all enjoy looking at this, and this will be well familiar to everybody. Roberts's view of Ballyshannon. And just to say a wee bit about the artist himself, he was born in Waterford in 1748. He was the son of an architect, and he made his name when he was just 18 with a major exhibition in Dublin, and he died of consumption when he was just 40. But that didn't stop him becoming a highly sought after landscape painter in his own lifetime. And this particular painting of Ballyshannon that we all know and love was one of a series of views that he did along the Erin. And that series of views ended up in a private collection in County Cavan, and then more recently ended up in the National Gallery in Dublin. He was in the Fermanagh, Erin, kind of Ballyshannon area in the early 1770s. And this painting, it's not coming up on the screen here, but what's so gorgeous about it first is the light and the expansiveness, and your eye is just drawn straight out onto the ocean that I've been banging the drum about is so important to the history of this town. It shows the tranquil but successful town. There's a lovely cluster of buildings up on the north side. You get that sense of kind of commercial mercantile activity. And then he also shows the infrastructure of the fishing along the river, and you can see the little hut on the weir and all that detail. And it's for all these reasons that it's an iconic and beloved representation of the town.
Now, just two things strike me about this. First of all, how beautiful it is, right? And never forget what a beautiful town it still is. Second thing, which is slightly, not a little bit more negative, is not that different from the profile you'd see today if you stood in the same position, right? I mean, I'd be curious to know, like, how many of those buildings are still standing in that painting?
Yeah, I haven't compared the actual buildings. Now, Barry might know because he painted this. Yeah. Barry produced a painting which is the same view, but of the town today. And yeah, you can put the two side by side and see some important differences, but the skyline is ultimately very similar. Roberts takes a bit of artistic license though, doesn't he, Barry? While the mic is reaching Barry there, like, we will remember this is the age of the sentimental traveller. Ballyshannon is taken off as a tourist destination, and it's very much portraying the town in that light.
Yeah, I always love that painting myself. I have a copy of it at home hanging on my wall, but it's a lot of it's kind of accentuated upwards for artistic effect or to make it look a bit more dramatic. You know, like you see St. Anne's Church, for example, is much higher. The tower, which was there at that time and still is there, is much higher than it is in reality. But you can see that the building itself has the cruciform shape that it doesn't have now because it was damaged and demolished in the wind and was rebuilt as kind of more barn-like shape. What's interesting about it to me as well is the old barracks that look like they're both on both sides of the river. Both sides of the bridge, yeah. And the barracks on the left remains where the museum is today. On the right hand side is that the castle of Folliot before it was demolished?
Yard that follows after. For everybody who might know as well, that this square, and I hope you can see it, when you look at the Roberts painting, there's a square set of walls just on the north side of the river. That's the parade yard that was laid out in about 1720 across the road from the barracks of 1700 on the site of what had originally been the O'Donnell Tower House and then was later the Folliot Castle. And then thirdly was the parade yard, and fourthly, the market charge.
I think what's very interesting about this painting is that it's looking westward, which is why the light becomes very, very important. And he did an almost identical painting, except it has some figures in the foreground in it. And both of those paintings survive, as does the original drawing he did. But he also did a painting which doesn't survive, or I think it's been lost, from the other side, looking eastward, which not so much of the bridge, but looking at the falls. And it's a great pity that that has been lost, because I'm sure it would have been a spectacular painting. He died a very young man, but he had 60 of his paintings survive. 15 of them relate to the Erin area, which I think is a reminder, again, that corridor running from the Erin estuary. And he did Belturbet, for example. He did Baleek. You can follow the path that was a travel where travellers came. They came from, they followed the Erin up towards Baleek and in towards Ballyshannon. And as I say, there are 15 Roberts paintings that reflect that journey.
Yeah, and of course, the last thing that's so wonderful about this painting is the spectacular view it gives us of the old bridge. Mm-hmm. And that little barricade in the middle of the bridge that reminds us, even though this is a lovely, tranquil view, things, 30 odd years later kick off in a big way again. And again, the garrison town comes to the fore, Ballyshannon, the defensive function.
I'm just keeping in the time here, guys. So we'll have to wrap up shortly. Anyone else from the audience? Yep, John?
A very quick story about the barracks on the rock that you talked about from the very start. My grandfather bought the hotel in 1902. And at some stage, while the British were there, the soldiers actually broke down through the floor of their barracks into his property, where he stored his whiskey and wines. And they stole the stuff. He was, of course, compensated. But to make sure it wouldn't happen again, the army put in a steel floor that we as kids, when we were growing up in the hotel, would often go up into the back storage area and see this big massive girders across. So that's just a wee funny thing about it.
That's fascinating. Thank you.
So it just reminds me, another thing I learned from the Atlas is that Dorian's Hotel was established in 1781.
Yeah, and again...
Benny's looking good on it, isn't he?
Yeah.
Well, another reminder of the town's heritage. So we've talked about it as a port town, a garrison town, a mercantile place, but also a tourist destination, you know. And there were plenty of travel accounts published from the mid-18th century right into the 20th century extolling what a wonderful place Ballyshannon was to come to visit, not just for the fantastic views of the Falls of Assaroe that we've sadly lost, that stupendous view, stunning noise, power of the air and rushing down into the sea, but some of the best saltwater and freshwater fishing in Western Europe as well.
Yeah, we're nearly coming to the end here, and I managed to get to the end, but Annie mentioned what's the word of the Erne's game, which is great. Okay. We had a very lively hedge good about this about 10 years ago, lad. So listen back to the podcast on that one. But this brings me to a wrap up, Angela, because one could be forgiven for thinking that the constant theme here is one of decline, stagnation, right? And it is a fact. I was struck by the fact that the population of town is like 3,000. Pretty much flatlines from the 18th century. I think it's down about 2,000 now, I believe. And that's kind of stating the obvious, like the problems the town has. But you suggest at the end that there are opportunities here for the town in terms of heritage and so on.
Yeah, I mean, there's that, you know, well-used phrase, but it's well-used because there's truth in it. You look back to look forward. So this town's proud history is one of looking outward to the ocean, one of taking advantage of its tremendous natural gift, which is location on the Erne, even if the Erne at Ballyshannon isn't what it used to be, even if we've lost Assaroe Falls. I think there's still loads of lessons to be drawn from the continuity and change that's charted in the Atlas.
Put that another way, this town could be as ugly as Errorkenny. But it isn't. And anyway, I mean, I see there's work already has started on renovating the old buildings in the town. Somebody else want to come in? Yeah.
It's just a quick question about where the customs house was on the Mall. I always thought that the customs house was down at Stevens, but I see in the map it was on the Mall. Was it Condon's house?
No, next door to that. So it did move later. But initially it was beside, it's well identified in the text. Yeah.
So would it have been where the three houses, Miller's and Carey's, lived?
Yeah, if you're going eastward from Condon House.
It's the first one?
Yeah, off the top of my head, yeah.
I notice Mr. Murphy and yourself getting very defensive about the ASB, but in defence of it, I have to say that the contribution to Ballyshannon in terms of the people who came to work in the cementation and who stayed, like your parents and so on, was tremendously important to what the town is now. Next year, or in 2027, the Musical Society and the Drama Festival will be celebrating their 75th anniversary. And together with those on the GA, the people that came to Ballyshannon have made a huge contribution to life in Ballyshannon and still do.
Yeah.
Ballyshannon never leads you, right? That's the way it is. Incidentally, if you want to listen to a bit more of Ballyshannon lore, you could check out Mark McMenamin's podcast, North and South. Anyone listen to it? Anyway, it's a new podcast, but he interviewed me last week, you know, so you can find out what I said about all these people here. Have we any else to say? I think we're going to wrap up, unless somebody else wants to come in from the floor before we finish.
Well, can I just say that you introduced Angela as the compiler of the Atlas. I have to say that that understates what she's produced, and I just want to congratulate her again.
Thank you. Yes. I wasn't sure what is the appropriate term, because it's not author. Is it author? Because it's more than that, though. It's like a curator. Anyway, correction taken on board. Hardly ever happens. Listen, I'd just like to thank all our speakers here, Pádraig Travers, Angela Byrne. Now, there are copies of the Atlas for sale in the bookshop in the foyer. It'll be set up tomorrow. I think a copy of this is, you know, absolutely essential for every person in this town. It'll just show you the town in a whole new way. There are several towns out there to be discovered. That's the way I'd look at it. Also, check out the latest issue of History Ireland. Will be on sale with Pádraig's review in it. And there's also an opinion piece by Micheál Ó-Shukrú, which actually goes into this whole question of maps and maps as part of conquest and so on. You know, a pretty muscular piece from Micheál. So check that out. And that's for sale in Pearse on Eales as well at Bridgend. So you've no excuse. And of course, I know you're all subscribers anyway, so I'm wasting my time here. Listen, I'd just like to thank everybody for coming along, particularly those people who contributed from the floor. And I hope to see you next year, next year's head school at Allingham. Thank you.